So just now continuing noticing what happens now that the bell rang. And you're not meditating again, right? Are there any questions? So far? So again, let me know if you can't hear. You can try, or you can come. So I understand that there's a couple of special or different things about this Dharma evening. And one is that you're all involved in Tovana. And two is that Tovana is kind of giving this to you, this chance to be together, by giving the Dana to me for the evening. And that's a cool thing. I like that. And so I suggested to talk about what are some of the particular challenges for us when we do have experience in meditation. So I just want to know if that is, I assume that's the case if you're involved in Tovana, that you've done a few retreats. Is that true? Or are some people volunteering and they haven't done much retreat? Have you done some retreats, everyone? So one of the main... obstacles, really, for us... is ideas. And our willingness to accept an idea. And to lean on the idea, to use the idea. In the beginning... we hear some ideas that at first, of course, are new. And it's exciting, and we feel enthusiastic, and we notice, hopefully, positive changes in our lives also, and in our minds and in our bodies and everything. And that's really good. But part of what's helpful there is that the new ideas are helping us let go of some old ideas, and that's what's helpful. Yeah? And then if we end up being just as uptight with the new ideas as we were with the old ones, we find ourselves feeling stuck and wondering what we're doing wrong, what's wrong with us, or what's wrong with something. But we don't want to look at what's actually wrong, which is that we're holding on to this idea. So it's partly because the idea has been so helpful. And it can be so many kinds of ideas. Even the idea that you could sit still for 45 minutes every day. The idea that you have a Saturday free and you could be in silence for the day. Those are great ideas. And we forget them. And it's good to remind each other of that. It's easy to remind each other of that, too. Even when it seems obvious and you feel shy to say, but say it, that's good. But just because an idea has been helpful, or so including in the idea is a technique, a practice, a way of life, etc. Even if it has been helpful, it doesn't mean that today it's what fits. Or let's put it another way, it doesn't deserve your loyalty. Do you know this word, loyalty? Tell me, it's part of the game is that I'm speaking English and you might know better English than I do, or you might not know any English, so you get to ask. And if you think, oh, everyone else understands and I don't, you're wrong, they don't understand. Even if they'd all be from the United States, native, born, whatever, speakers of English. So please help by asking if you don't understand. And we can use the excuse of the language gap as a reason that you should feel free to ask. I know a few great teachers, really great teachers who have really deep practice and experience and really good way of expressing the teachings that's really helpful for many people. And still, somewhere in the teachings, you hear them saying, like Chogyam Trungpa. There's also Bernadette Roberts, this great Christian mystic who's really telling it like it is. And then at the end of the book, she's like, but, you know, of course Christianity has this, the best way. And then Chogyam Trungpa says, well, you know, Tibetan Buddhism really has the best way. And everywhere you go, you find these really great teachers with a great experience who still secretly or openly think that their way is actually the best way. And sometimes in the Buddhist tradition, it'll be like, oh, well, we don't talk bad about the Theravadins anymore. But we don't say lesser vehicle anymore, which is what it used to be. And even traditionally, Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, the lesser way, and then the greater way, then the lightning way. We don't say that anymore. All of those ways are really good preparations for our way. And it's also in the Patanjali Yoga Sutras as one of the obstacles that you will come across. So if they came across it, it probably is going on in some way in ourselves. And just to be, it's just a little bit about honoring your own sensitivity. When you start to feel something feel stuck or less sensitive, like you can't feel, you can't hear, you would like to listen, you need some freshness, but you're not hearing anything fresh. Well, maybe it's because there's not listening happening. There's not sensitivity either. There's some holding to something that was helpful. Thank you very much. Just like everything else, it's here and it's gone. And it's not where our loyalty needs to be. So gratitude is good in there. That's another idea, but anyway. Gratitude can be better than loyalty to a lifestyle, a technique, a way, and even really great teaching ideas that were good at breaking apart other ideas. But if we can rather feel that in our openness as a human being, should I slow down for this, for you to translate? Should I go more slow? Okay. In our own openness and sensitivity, there is something that matches that openness that happens when an idea is let go, an idea is crushed, or an idea is like, what? I was being mean to someone because I wanted to meditate about the benefit of all beings. Something in us, I would say the word love, but I know not everyone loves the word love. In our openness, there's a correspondence, there's a match, there's a rhyme with the openness that happens when an idea isn't taken too seriously. And that's something we can practice. Leaving room for what's already spacious in ourselves that can feel the spaciousness of things. How good it is when the idea isn't leading the way, when the idea isn't dominant, the belief, the certainty, etc. So just in a one, I don't want to limit how many different situations we're talking about, but one example still to help ground what we're talking about is just orientation towards our daily practice, which I hope you have a daily practice of some kind. It doesn't mean that I hope you're necessarily sitting cross-legged for 45 minutes, unless that's what you really love. If that's what you really love and you find really helpful for now, I really hope you're doing it. But just orientation to whatever you do every day that is helpful. And sometimes hard and sometimes easy, but deeply helpful. And deeply leaving room for your natural capacity to grow, for the openness, the confidence, the humility to grow. It's really simple. When I have my idea of my practice, it feels like one thing. Yeah? And how I relate to that idea of my practice, whether I'm so proud that I do my practice, and I want people to know, but I don't want to say it out loud because I'm so humble, but I do hope they notice how early I got up to do my, not 45 minutes, but 1 hour, or 2 hours, or whatever. Or how I know that I really should, but I'm not, and I haven't for a whole week, and what I've... That's all to the idea. And what is another way? Because sometimes the idea helps remind us to go and do nothing for 45 minutes or an hour or 3 hours or a day. So sometimes the idea reminds us that we're allowed to be still for 45 minutes and do nothing for 3 hours and spend a whole Saturday in silence. The idea can be helpful. But if that starts to be the main thing that we're relating to, the idea of my practice and how good or how bad it's going, etc. What's another way that you're finding? And I'm happy now to be old enough to tell you how great it is to get older and to have experience. To actually have life experience. So it's not just only your best guess, but it's based on some resources that are actually available because of what you've done in the past. So do your daily practice and do your ritual and serve in Sovana and do what you love to do. Go and meet friends, etc. As Tomel said, it works. And so there are some things that do get easier, that does get easier to start to feel when we're getting off track and onto the idea instead of the actual practice flow, which has a life of its own and isn't found in the book and doesn't always get confirmation from what everyone else is doing or did. So this is another area now we're starting to step into, another area of challenge for when we do have some experience. And it's still actually about ideas, but we could call it maybe norms. So I want to give a kind of an extreme comparison to how we can live within a spiritual theme, how we can do that, and how I would recommend not to be within a spiritual theme. So in, let's call the mainstream culture, it's interesting noticing, so I've spent a lot of my life living outside the mainstream culture, a lot of my life living in India, for example, and then the last 10 years, half the year in India, half the year in the middle of nowhere in Spain. So there's not advertising coming in, there's not a movie that I didn't want to watch on TV that I can't stop watching or whatever. That just doesn't happen. Which I love and highly recommend. And that helps it be more noticeable, the poor quality of what's happening, for example, in movies, which I think they have a lot of power and a lot of potential. But how similar the movies still are from what they were 10 years ago and 20 years ago, except more bad is what it seems like from the previews. I don't watch them. How can that be? Because there are people who are really creative. Some of them are geniuses who are actually working on these movies. And they feel like they're like having breakthroughs with these movies. And maybe technologically they probably are, the sound effects even. And then, of course, the visual is certainly improving when we think of the old Star Wars and we think of what comes out now. But so what? And I know this is really obvious, but I want to talk more now about the content of the movies and how that comes about. So maybe I'll tell one of these strange little things that happens in life. I was the guest of a guest, as does sometimes happen when one lives outside of the mainstream and goes home to get a visa and makes some money. I was the guest of a guest, and the husband of the hostess, you can put it that way, was the ex-husband of Diana Ross, who maybe, I've never even heard her, but she used to be famous. And Diana Ross is in what's called the Academy, which is people who are allowed to vote for the Academy Awards for the movies, which I assume you've heard of. She didn't have time to watch all the movies, so she sent them to her ex-husband to watch, to tell her. And along with these movies to watch to vote on for the Academy Awards, she sent a script that someone had sent her that if she wanted to act in the movie, and she was trying to get her career back on or whatever. And he was like, he said to me, because you went to Harvard, like, you got to read this and tell me. It was the most ridiculous story in the world. And I'm sure it got made into a movie. And I'm sure it got, like, like when they come out with the second and third. It started with a psychopath in a hospital who escaped. Give me a break. I was like, you've got to be kidding. This is such a bad movie. You can't tell her to be in this movie. And then I saw a preview for a movie like that. I was like, oh, I probably ruined her career. So someone thinks, like, what's going to be, like, the most cool, far-out storyline? A psychopath in a hospital who figures out how to escape from the hospital. And so within the norms that there are, within certain boundaries of basically what's going to get a reaction, people are creating stories. And that's then what we all, not all, but that sort of like becomes the mainstream culture. And that's accepted also. There isn't someone in that who's saying, and even if they did, it wouldn't be made into a film in Hollywood. What would actually be good for us? What would be good for us? What would be good for the children? What would be good for the adults? I can't watch those movies. I would have nightmares for months. Really? The previews are enough. And the children's movies, to try to find a children's movie now that isn't so dark and scary, made for children, supposedly. This is happening, and it's been happening for 20 years at least. And it's really understandable. That's why I'm bringing this up. It seems unrelated, I'm sure. But it's happening because people who do have some brains and some creativity and some sort of initiative are like, okay, what will be a project that I can get funding for and that people will come and watch so that it will be successful? This story. Not the story that I would have maybe told if I had any space to think about what story would I like to tell or what story would be good out there. What story do they want to hear? Do they actually want to hear that? No. We've gotten used to hearing that. And so it's something is just about like slightly playing with the edges of the norms and pushing the norms a little bit. So then it just gets more dark and more violent. Literally dark, like it's almost black and white, but not quite. And then there's some blood, basically. So what does this have to do? It's really easy for this to happen to really smart, well-intentioned people, creative people, good people. It's happening. And the same kind of thing happens in a spiritual scene. There are some norms that get established. No one's quite sure exactly how they, or even why they got established, often. They're usually not spoken about. Sometimes they come up, but they're often not spoken about. And then, if at all, we'll just sort of slightly tickle those norms. And that's considered creativity, or that's considered going really far, or going really deep, or being really original. But it's not original in the sense of actually coming back to maybe why did you start to practice, or what did you do before you practiced? Sometimes we have to go back. What made sense to you? What was joyful before you started meditation? And then, oh yeah, maybe that's why I started to meditate. And can we also get outside of the occupation of trying to clean up our act to feel what would be good for us? And not also us, this, whatever you're, this is you, this is y'all, but also a bigger and a bigger and a bigger us. What would be good now? And not to think that because you're nice and quiet and you want some silence and you've got so much inner work to do and you hardly have time to do your meditation practice, but that that's not a key part of your path. To wake up that part of our mind that can actually feel what is good for us and can do something about it. And that, it doesn't mean heroism. So I finally get to read a poem. A bird the size of a leaf fills the whole lucid evening with its note and flies. That's the poem. I'll read it again. I'll just explain a few of the words. So what does lucid mean? Someone who knows English better than I do.
Salud.
Salud. Okay. That's a nice sound. Was there any other word? I think they're all fairly easy word. A bird the size of a leaf fills the whole lucid evening with its note and flies. That's what I'm saying. It's possible. Question? Note.
Tav.
Lee, Tav, Tavim. It's not about what we've gotten used to thinking of as big, which is some kind of pushing the edges to get a little bit of adrenaline. It's a completely different direction that feels like inward but doesn't stop in. It doesn't assume that in is only in. It doesn't assume that in is a stopping place of any kind. And so when we go back to, like, where did that turning in or wanting to turn in start? What did that feel like? What did it taste like? And where did I stop that with myself? Because it has a way of not only being here and not only going everywhere here, but... So sometimes in a spiritual theme there might be a norm that we get into, for example, working on one's psychology or getting concentration or sitting still for a long time or doing lots of retreats, etc. So just a few more examples. And none of that is going to feed. It's not nourishment. Sometimes if it helps remind us that we can remember of the possibility of, oh yeah, I really wanted to sit longer and I can. That's completely different from a norm that I'm working with. That it's obviously better to sit longer. And it's inside yourself that that can happen. That getting free from that gravitation to the norm. Looking and hooking onto a norm to feel normal. And kind of remembering the part of you that actually didn't start this in order to feel normal. You might have wanted to feel well. Could be. And you know in your experience that well and normal don't overlap much. A life can look normal and be well, but then when you talk to the person, it's not normal. So I'm not saying we should all be doing weird things like living in India and the middle of, like, welcome, but, you know, it's everyone finding our way step by step and later telling about it. Not deciding now what I should do and trying to follow my own instructions. So it's really simple, but it is also completely different orientation that is trust your life. And then later you can describe it. We would like to describe it and know what's happening first, and then we're allowed to live. And maybe we'll discover something if we have any energy left over, which we don't. Because it's a completely different mode. Are there any questions or anything to share yet so far?
Can you say again the last thing you said?
I'll try, yeah. If I can repeat the last thing. Okay. I'll repeat it by saying it in a different way, using the example of in meditation practice, where part of the practice, like we did in the guided meditation, was receiving our experience. When I'm trying to receive my experience, so I'm feeling, there's an allowance of sounds and the sounds are happening. There's an allowing of the body sensations to come and go, and so that's happening. There's allowing of thinking, oh right, that's also happening, that's true, okay. And then, oh yeah, there's also a state of mind, that's also happening, okay. And there maybe is room for something else, okay. And probably we go in and out of sometimes as an occupation, I'm trying to be with, allow, feel, etc. And sometimes it's happening. Either way, but more so when it's happening. So I'm more in a space where I'm allowing things to happen, including a sense of me that's stronger and less strong. That's also happening. Something unexpected can pop up, which I'm calling discovery. Discovery. Something unexpected can pop up. It might be something not spectacular that when we say it out loud, it's like, oh yeah, everybody knows that. But the feeling is something fresh. The feeling is that it was unexpected. I'm going to give another very far out example. Sometimes. this Jaya. Once upon a time on this planet, there was a war. And there were some soldiers that were trying to retreat to safety in a tank. And they had also prisoners of war from the other side with them, hanging onto the tank. It was snowing, and it was December 22nd, I think. So a few days before Christmas. And to get back to safety, they had to go through fire. They had to cross fire. Okay? So people from both sides holding onto one tank in the snow, going through bullets, going through whatever, what would that be called? Anyway. Crossfire. One person, I mean, that's a terrible situation for everyone. One person started to sing Silent Night, which is a beautiful Christmas song in English. Someone else started to sing it with him. Someone else started to sing it with him. Someone else started to sing it in another language, the same song, from the other side. They're singing the same Christmas song, going through the bullets on a tank in the snow. So that someone who sings, suddenly, they may not have decided to sing, or maybe they're like, I really want to sing, but I shouldn't sing. How could I sing in this situation? Maybe. Or maybe they just started singing. It doesn't matter. They sang. One person started to sing. Someone else also started to sing. And then as another person starts to sing, it gets easier. So this is, and then someone from the other side started to sing in the other language. That's another kind of crossing. In the poem, which I didn't bring because it was a lot of difficult English and not so short, one thing I love about the poem is it's talking about the tank moving and those tracks of a tank. Muffled is the word, by the snow. And so this is where there's the importance of being together and where one person can do something that's like a discovery. It's something unexpected that happens that can be followed. And it tends, even though it has a lot of impact, and it's one of those moments that I would say kind of lasts forever, the tracks of the tank are muffled by the snow. There's something in the situation that doesn't leave a trace in the same way as when we have the norms that we would like to feel normal by staying inside of. It's almost the opposite. And the feeling is totally different of when something's really leaving tracks. Is it okay? Should I rewind? Okay. Not that I could. <really good. laughs> And the feeling of something that's worth following that's not leaving tracks. Yeah? So we might as well from here go right in to the kind of core of what's important. I received an email from a close friend and student yesterday. She has been having a terrible time for years, like really terrible time. Really hard time. And especially this year, 2014, a really hard time because she's starting to open that she might be able to feel loved. And it's terrible for her. It hurts her. It's, of course, what she has been, her whole practice has been building towards and what she needs and what she's kind of ready for. And it's so painful to be open, for her, to be open and feel loved. She is. it's so terrible that many times she goes the other way. Like, she runs away from where there's someone who's loving her. Like, literally. She won't show up to the meeting, or she'll go to another country, or... In the email yesterday, she said she just remembered this line from a song, which is something like, I started out to disappear. I wanted to disappear. And now that I'm disappearing, I know I'm home. So there's this curious contrast between the discovery of what helps each individual person connect. It's very personal. It also changes with time. It's very personal how the process, how the changes happen. Personal in the sense of unique, maybe a better word. And then the contrast between how individual that is, and then connection to... what was I connecting to? Oh, I wanted to connect to myself, I think. To myself. What is that, actually? I wanted to connect to myself. What is myself? And we easily get... We get tricked, or we trick ourselves, or whatever. We kind of enjoy wasting time thinking, oh, I'm being with myself, and really we're being with our shit. We're not being, we haven't yet had so much contact with ourselves. And it's partly because of the language. We think, I want to connect with myself. That sounds really solid and simple and clear and basic and easy. And what is myself? What did I want to connect to? Where? What was that wanting? Who had that wanting? Who wanted to connect with myself? How many of me are there? And then it's still this basic, simple process, what helped connect to what we think of maybe as myself. Accepting what my experience of myself is. What is your experience of yourself? Tell me. Yes. Yes. Sorry and not sorry. No.
It's very rich in so many parts of it. Mm-hmm. I feel sensitivity and gratefulness and quiet and a lot of emotions. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about I have to go there later.
Mm-hmm. So we could, we're not going to, but we could, and sometimes, maybe 10% of people, 10% of the time, maybe, it is useful to think through who wants to be there, why, like, but really, literally, not tricky spiritual advice, like, I want to be there, why do I want to be there? Because my child is waiting for me there, because my wife needs to need to be there, because she has to go, whatever, or whatever. Why is that important to me to go and be there when not? Maybe I said I'd be there, or I can't wait to see my child, I love bath time, or whatever. And still, but where did that come from? All of that. So sometimes, but we're not going to do more than what I just did more than I said. It can help us to feel the open-endedness and the where did that come from and where did that come from? Where did the love of my child come from? Where did the willingness to follow through on a commitment come from? Where did love come from? And whose? But really. And it doesn't mean whose, like, ah, so you don't bother. You don't need to be there. but acceptance of the fact that we can't quite get a handle on who myself is. We cannot. And when we think we have a handle on it, we've gone into the norms and the ideas, and we've lost track with from our starting place. We've lost track of our starting place. So, to play a little bit with this trace and not trace, we're kind of orienting by the traces that we can see or feel or think about, like, that worked last time, so I should do that again. It ends up being a lot about shoulds and shouldn'ts. It's an easy way to recognize when we're not with that traceless. You can say, like, act of discovery or enactment of discovery or that place where the unexpected has some, there's some openness to the unexpected. Not that we expect it to look different from the normal. We're not trying to make it weird. And so then that leaves room for that I did have to leave early and I did go and I was on time and I am with my child, who I also is a mystery, as well as the love between us is a mystery, as well as everything. And we're there. Without knowing what we are. We don't know what's there. So Jay Krishnamurti talks about that as long as we orient around the sense of me. So let there be a sense of me along with the sound of the parakeet. So what? But when there's all the dynamic forces that encourage us also to orient around the sense of me. As long as there is a center, the me or the idea of me, he says, so he's on the same page. And he says, with all its attachments, I mean, that word, we don't know what it means anymore for the wrong reason. Not because we've investigated it so deeply that we're into the mystery of it, but because we've used it too much without really getting into what's the felt sense of attachment. So I would tend to call it more a sense of lack. So as long as there is a center, the me or the idea of me, with all its sense of not enough, is the way I would like to put it. To translate Krishnamurti's English to today. Not enough of whatever, inside or outside. So as long as there's a center, the me, or the idea of me, with its sense of not enough, that very center creates a space around itself, and when there's a center, there must be a border. So there's space and there's a border. Center, space, border. The border may be extended, but... It's a border. Meditation means, this is Krishnamurti, to come upon that space in which there is not a center. To come upon that space in which there's no center. And then he later goes to make sure we really don't try to start creating and forcing and pretending and projecting and imagining that we're in a space without a center. Not the invention, not the projection, not bringing it about through whatever technique. Meditation, this is Krishnamurti though, so how are you taking in relating to his idea? Meditation means to come upon that space in which there's no center, therefore no direction, therefore no time. And then when we hear the last one, we're like, oh, well, I can't really live that way in my daily life here in Tulu, so maybe I can feel a little spacious. And that'll be good enough. And then something in us that's a deep fire also feels that something more important is also going on. And we can feel conflict. And so this is another challenge when we have experience. One of the first challenges that we have is to get over ourselves, to get over our perfectionism and criticism. So to be able to notice that there's anger in the mind, there's fear, etc., in the body. To keep coming upon these things and not be really upset with ourselves. to start to be more easygoing about the fact that there's all of these reactions much of the time. That's a huge step, and it's a huge challenge. Not to be insulted by our experience. And it gets harder in a way. And so this is, I want to really be more specific. When people have been practicing a long time, whatever that you might think, 1 year is a long time, or 20 years a long time, whatever, and then you keep practicing, it just gets longer. And then you have a really serious problem somewhere in your life, in your work or your relationship or your health or whatever. It will happen. And then you feel so ashamed that you're completely falling apart, or that you're having the same argument again, or whatever. A panic attack, or whatever. You think, oh, if I've been doing all of this practice, how is it possible? And if anyone would know how bad it is and how bad I am. And so if we could know that that happened, and that it doesn't help to think that it shouldn't happen or shouldn't be happening, that you're wrong, at least if we can know that, it doesn't help to think it shouldn't be happening. And it does happen to many people. And it is a big challenge to actually be with it and with yourself. As if it's never going away. It means that little to yourself as how you think of your self-image. Let it be, let the panic attacks come till I die. May it not be so, but if it is, it doesn't take away any gram, milligram of the preciousness of this human life. It does not affect the value of the life. It does not affect the value of your practice. Sometimes it can help to have the sense that now that I've practiced so much, here's a nice, big, juicy challenge that I couldn't have even noticed or given any room to even 1 year ago. And now I can't handle it. It's too much for me. But at least there's some openness that's allowed to happen. Otherwise, we have 30 years of practice. Let's say you have 20 and you're having a problem and you think it's so much. Then you're going to have 30 years of practice and your shadow is going to be even bigger. So it's not to grow the shadow. That means it's not to repress and deny more and more and more. That's not the goal. And we know that when I say it like that. Of course it's not. Of course I'm not meditating to deny. But we do. Because we think we should be able to handle. And we shouldn't feel angry or fearful or insecure or whatever. So, one big help is already come. But you can come. Boy. Bo. The big help and the main thing that's actually needed is to let it be, to not think it shouldn't be, to know that in some way there's going to be that huge challenge for everyone. So you're not alone with it. It's not your secret shame party. That's usually almost all that we can do and all that we need to do. And it just gives a little bit more room for then something to pop up and something to pop up and something to pop up. And then you start to be able to look back. You wish that happened sooner, but it didn't. But you start to be able to look back at some point. And you start to notice how that terrible experience helped extend your capacity in so many ways, but especially love and steadiness. Even though the whole time you were like this, and you hated yourself for it, and you hated yourself for hating yourself for it, and it was so intense. But even so, there was a little bit that wasn't freaking out. And because it was so humbling, and we start to feel the fine difference between humiliation and humbling, because we at some point cannot take it so personally anymore. We cannot take our difficult experience as an insult anymore. We don't have any energy left because it's so intense. Between humiliation and humbleness, maybe I didn't say it right. Humiliation and humility, humbleness. Humiliation is a sense that I've been put down by life or by not being good enough. I'm down. It's taking an event or a situation as a put down. That's what I'm saying, as an insult. But we feel down because we're suffering. That's when we feel humiliated. And humility, which is the root of like being on the ground, the soil. The microphone is showing us. Because what?
When do we understand
first person? One thing that happens in really intense, ongoing struggles is at a certain point, there's no extra energy for any unnecessary movement of mind. So there's not even enough to feel ashamed. There's not even enough to think this is a put down again. So the heaviness of the time, repetition again. And also that energy of being down, accepting this as a down, life hates me, I'll never get it right, etc. It's the essence of the me, something is not enough. But taken as a bad thing. What if we take not enough, or not quite what we expected, or not complete, or something, not as a problem? And the problemness of it not as the as a center, but just as one other aspect. Yeah. Not complete. So that's one way. I mean, another way is just the clear noticing that it isn't me, and that also if I actually hear from people, they also have intense experiences and so on, that it's not that I invented anger or insecurity or shame. It's not an energy that I created and bathed in. It's part of the mystery of the human being that we experience these things. We all do. And different situations, very similar chemistry and so on. There are other ways, not only through intense suffering, to start taking our good and bad experiences less personally. And part of that is this process of taking our perfectionism and criticism less seriously. And that's huge. And then there can come a time, a moment, or a sense of that we've maybe lost track of some kind of open-endedness or bottomlessness, measurelessness, in being so accepting that maybe there'll be panic attacks forever, maybe there'll be insecurity forever. That's not all that there is. That's not all that's going on, and it's also not my problem. And it maybe isn't even a problem. It helps to remember, and it helps that we help each other remember also. And when the perfectionism is less fiery, it's much It's a different thing to hear about our possibility for actually being free in this life. So sometimes there's so much need for years and years and years and years that it's mostly about acceptance and not making a big deal about the fact that the mind is doing all of these acrobatics. That sometimes we are almost afraid to again open up to the possibility that also we feel and need room for, that also freedom. And in between there, we have the chance to experience freedom even though. So, not freedom from anger, but freedom even though anger. Not freedom from insecurity. The insecurity is still coming up, but it doesn't affect me. It's not me. I can also feel it, and there can be a response that's healing to that. But it's not with an agenda because I'm so ashamed that I'm insecure that I've got to get rid of it so that then I'm okay and then I can be myself. It's none of the, not that step-by-step process. It's more direct, more immediate. Less of, like Krishnamurti's, there's no direction and no time. It's not that kind of, then I'll do that, and then I'll do that, and then I'll be okay. It's also okay, though insecure and angry and messy, and also okay already. And from okay already, feeling the insecurity is a totally different insecurity. And there is some kind of response, which might be nothing. It might be therapy. It might be jogging or cycling. It might be doing a handstand for half an hour or whatever. And we need to do that. And that's one other small thing that we kind of touched on, but just to really state it. Sometimes when we have gotten like that really good meditative like vibe, and we like it, and it feels good, and we get good feedback for being such a good meditator, so calm and steady, and that when it comes time that we actually do need to go and climb a tree or stand on our hands for half an hour, we're very reluctant, purely because of our image, purely because of pride. And so if we could be that honest with ourselves, no one else in Tovana is standing on their hands for half an hour. Probably they are. Probably they are. But that doesn't matter. It's when the calling is to do something that you're not seeing around you, so you're not orienting by the norm or the idea. It's from something, some freshness. And it's, again, when you're willing to feel, then that's a need. Like when you're hungry, you eat. When you need to go to the bathroom, you go to the bathroom. When you need to stand on your hand, you stand on your hand. And when there are those, as I said in the beginning, those spiritual ideas that did help in the beginning, and then they start to get really comfortable, and we got our friends who all do that and everything, there will come a time that we need to cross some of those lines. It will need to be done. Not out of some aggression, though. So we can't plan it. And when it happens, we feel we weren't quite ready. Any question, comment, sharing? Do you need to, like, stand up and shake yourself a little bit before we go on? Let's do. We still have maybe 15, 20 minutes of teaching time on the schedule. So if you can handle that holding your pee that much longer, mm-hmm. then do. If you can't, then. So just to kind of review, that's the last part there. before we stood up. Because it's really maybe the most important thing, I think, for us as we have experience in meditation. So the importance of acceptance, and the importance of through practicing acceptance and letting the perfectionism and criticism die down, we start to again be able to bear the thought that we're not perfect and that there is more freedom possible. There are more natural capacities that are growing, and we don't always know why, and it's not only in our hands to make that happen, but we can feel that it's happening, and that's important. So when there's not acceptance, what happens is we come to practice, and at first it's kind of maybe exciting because it's like, wow, this is possible. And then we come up to the reality of whatever is going on in the psyche that's really happy to be met finally, and then you're like, oh no, I didn't want to meet you. I'm supposed to meet peace and stability and happiness and love. If there isn't the basic and ongoing acceptance, then at some point we can't take it, and we will instead take some idea. And so one thing that happens is the idea that you're already free, for example. The idea that comes in the teachings of non-duality. So there's many, many people who will take the idea, oh, well, I'm already enlightened. I'm already... So this appearance of anger isn't mine. They'll take the idea that it's not mine, because that seems convenient, basically. It's too much trouble to keep practicing. It does become unbearable to keep facing things that we didn't expect to meet in ourselves and that we think shouldn't be there. And that there will be some escape that will happen, which is a dead end. And that dead end can last till you die. So don't do it. Rather than saying, this shouldn't be here, or let me work harder to get rid of it, or let me find a better technique to work on it, I better take another workshop, or let me go try that modality and that modality. All of that can be helpful, but... when it's coming from this place of trying to get around the fact that things are in our experience that we thought we think shouldn't be there. What we could rather take out is this stake that we think it shouldn't be there. That's all. And we think when it is there that it's in the way between me and freedom, between me and enlightenment. And when we actually meet whatever it is, we always find it as a way in towards freedom, always. When we don't meet it because we think it shouldn't be there, it seems to be an obstacle. Because of my own resistance, because of my own idea, because of my own unwillingness to meet the unexpected. When I find the childlike adventure part that's like, cool, something unexpected that I used to think was anger, but what actually is this heat that I feel in my body? Is it actually anger? We start to have questions and openness, and we find ourselves in an experience that goes somewhere helpful. When I have the idea that I should go into it to get rid of it, then usually I'm going in a way still with resistance, and I'm not actually, the thing isn't being met. I'm still meeting my idea with too much force also. And then I wound the wound. So gradually, so at times we can find our way. We notice we've gotten off track. We feel like we can't feel. We notice that we're blind. And that is enough. Notice that you're blind. Notice that you can't feel. Feel that you can't feel. Something. You can feel a lot, but you can't feel something. You notice that you can't feel. Good. Don't turn away from that. Don't think it's wrong also. Good. You feel that you can't feel some area. I don't mean only physically, of course. As we start to come across again, so we come upon that space in which there's no center, we come upon things that are helpful. We come upon a step that gets taken that might never happen again, but it was helpful then, or it might happen every day for the rest of our lives, and it's helpful. We come upon what's helpful. Something in us responds or responded, yeah. And sometimes that feels like joy. So joy sometimes is a helpful guiding line of what needs to be more in your life. What situation, what person, what activity, what kind of atmosphere. Inner and outer. Joy. When you notice that it feels dry and you stop, you're not quite as sensitive, dry, okay, juice, where's the juice? Sometimes it's that simple. You can't, you only have 1 hour, are you going to do your yoga, are you going to do your vipassana, are you going to do your just lying down? You can't decide. What feels more juicy? What feels more joyful? We think we can't trust that because we think it's the same as what's pleasant. It's not the same. And the Buddha talks about, the Gautama Buddha talks about that very simply and clearly. He talks about the joy that isn't through stimulation, through getting what I want, through not getting what I don't want. He said there is another kind of pleasure, actually he calls it sukha, happiness, pleasure. And he was also afraid at first. Is that pleasure that brings you down eventually? No, this is a different kind. And I'm still afraid, but I'm gonna go for it. This was the turning point in his path. And it's a turn, you can feel it's a turning point. It's a radical shift. Simple and easy. It's not a big deal many times. It's not always like in the biography of the person, that moment that it was for him in that time. It's a different kind of pleasure, a different kind of joy, juice. So sometimes we can easily feel, this is joyful, do more of that. That easy. As we go along, sometimes it isn't that easy to feel juice and joy. It's more of a lightness that we would follow if we had permission. So give your permission for that natural following of what's no longer joyful but is light, lighter. And then we don't know why. We don't know how, but we know. That's what we need to do. This is when the mind can start to cooperate also. It's not just meh, 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 meh. It's, and we think, oh, it's silly. Again, give permission. Give your permission. For that thing that came not because you saw the bird that reminded you of that other bird that reminded you of 10 years ago when you read that book about being aware of the out-breath. Maybe it could come that way. It could come that way. But more often it's just an idea that's easy to put off till tomorrow because no one else is doing that. Or whatever. Okay. Any questions so far? So I'd like to use a teaching from Gautama Buddha that's called the bait. You know what the word bait means? Bait.
Bittayun.
Bittayun. Sounds almost the same. Bittayun. Bait. What?
Pita.
Pita.
Bittayun.
Bittayun.
You remember.
So this is bait that is food. I mean, I think bait is usually food, right? Poisoned food. Okay. we might have thought when we heard about meditation that it's going to make our life easier, and it's not. It's going to make certain things easier, and it's going to make also certain things wider. And it's going to remind you daily of your wider capacity as a human being. And you can't deny it. You can ignore it, etc., but something in you. Me? Would like to have some ceiling. Some roof, some wall. And there isn't. And that includes periodically ever-expanding challenge. And that's where we can take challenge as a kind of compliment. It's just a natural part of the process that we realize we can. Something that we thought, I didn't do that. But then we realize we can, and there's that situation, and it's all open, and so we do. Or we don't, or whatever. And so when we thought it was going to be this, so they talk about the refuge, let's take refuge. It's a trick. A trick. Let's take refuge. Take refuge in the Buddha. Take refuge in awakening. Yeah, right. Awakening has a roof, does it? Does it have walls? Does it even have ground? Your potential to be awake? Refuge? Give me a break. At first we go in and we're like, oh, I can feel safe here. I feel safe with these people. And then when you feel safe, what happens? Openness happens. And then when openness happens, what happens? Everything. Everything. And there's no escape because there's not a wall. But it does so happen that we start to realize that we don't need the wall. And we also need not wall. We even need not wall. Something really wants, and we think we're going to die if we don't get wall. And something in us knows that human being knows there is no wall and there's no need for a wall. And that part that is small, here we start to have, I'm sure we're going to have some wraps coming this year. Wall and small. Yes, there's a part that feels small and wants a wall. Yes, it's true. And that is not all. So you can remember this easily. Small wants a wall, and that's not all. And small can have big. Big can attend to small. Like, big mind is totally fine with small mind, has no problem with small mind. Small mind can believe that there is no big mind, but big mind doesn't care. That's fine. Big can take care of small, and small can feel small. So small can have some refuge and care and tending that it didn't get before, and that is part of the process. But that's not all. It's not even half. It's not even, it's maybe 10%. It's what we spend a lot, and we're active there, trying to get with our small and get the small and the big together and all of that. Heal the inner child. It's good. And it seems to be all sometimes. And it's... So in this teaching that's passed down, that's said that the Gautama Buddha said this, in response to a certain group of people sometime, somewhere. So there's a group of deer, and there's a group of hunters. And the hunters use bait to catch the deer, which I already find an interesting idea, that you would poison something that you want to eat, but anyway. it's poison for the deer, so that they can catch the deer, so that they can eat the deer. Interesting. It is true also. Like, that part that's aggressive, that wants to catch something that's wild and light-footed, you thinks of poison. But it doesn't think, well, then I'm going to eat that, which means I'm going to actually, I'm baiting myself in a way. But that's not in his version of the story. But today is another day, another group. Well, it's not ecologic. It's the situation, and today is, we're adding to the Gautama Buddha Sutta. So what happens is that the first, there's a first herd, there's actually four herds of deer. And the first herd of deer, herd, group of deer, doesn't realize what's happening, and they go and they eat the bait and they're caught. And that's the end of the herd number one. Gone. And the way that it's described is that they're unwary. So they don't realize how strong the habit energies can be. And so they don't, they're not aware, unwary. They're unaware. And in a way we could say careless. They're not quite caring about themselves. They're just eating what looks good without smelling it. And then they eat the bait and they become intoxicated. And I like that he uses this, he apparently used that word in the teaching. So something happens and we get into a habit energy or a pattern or a power dynamic or something like that. And then we're in it. We're intoxicated by it. We have that brain chemistry going on. That's in our blood in that for a certain period of time. So even if I somehow or a good friend somehow gets me out of that just in time, I'm still intoxicated for a while. I still feel the fear in my blood. So I like that he used that. But usually when we're intoxicated, we're caught into that habit energy with the help of shame. And we become negligent, he says. So already we were not really paying attention. We didn't realize how precious our life is, maybe. We didn't learn to respond to the needs that are there. We think we should put the needs till tomorrow and do what everyone tells us to do today. And so then we eat the wrong thing. And we think, oh, I can handle it. I've done a lot of meditation. And then we're intoxicated. And we may not realize yet that we're intoxicated. We might not want to admit that we are now experiencing the chemistry of depression for something so small. It can't be. It can't be. It can't be. But it is. And they've done studies now, so we get all of this brain studies now that help us be much more aware and caring about the precious moments of our lives and where we're eating and what we're eating and the sense of, like, real nourishment, spiritual nourishment. Intoxicated, it's much harder. It's much harder when we're drunk on fear or anger or insecurity or shame or whatever. It's much harder to do anything. So negligent, in the sense of a deer with hunters around, you're not you're even less aware of how important your life is and how close the end of your life is. And how you're the one who could do or could have done something different. And so the deer trapper comes and does what he wants with you. Then the second herd notices what happened to the first herd and says, instead of just hanging around where all that bait is, we know that that's bait now. We know that habit energies are strong. We know how easy it is to get triggered. So I'm just going to keep away. We're going to go way out there where there's no hunters and no bait. And they do. And they're totally fine for a long time. And then comes the last month of the hot season and there's not enough to eat and they're weak with hunger. So translate this to meditation, which is what it's about. And the deer are obviously the meditators. We try to just stay away from all that bad stuff or all that stuff that makes us feel bad or makes us be crazy. We try to be completely away from it, and it works for a while. And just like they found, they've done studies about actual, like, physical security, let's say in rich communities in the United States, people will keep moving to a new house with more security. And now they go to the gated communities where there's even more security. And it works for a while. For 1 year it works. And then it doesn't, it's not any more safe than living outside the gate. It works for 1 year. And then people even more want to get in there and they figure out how. So very similarly, there's not that kind of escape with what's difficult or what's staying true. So the second herd lost and they had to go back, and they weren't used to being around the bait, so they were unwary. They hadn't practiced like having a nibble of bait. And so they got negligent and they got caught in end of herd number two. Herd number three saw what happened the first two times and said, okay, we're going to do a new thing. We're going to stay around the bait so that we practice being around the bait and not being unwary. We're going to be aware of the challenges. We're going to be aware of the strength of the habit energies. We're going to be aware of how much biology pushes us around that we wouldn't like to admit, fear of death, sexual energy, etc. We're going to be aware of that, and we're going to live right in the middle of it. And the hunters say, these deer are so tricky, they're like witches and sorcerers. What if we surround them with loops of cane or something so that we'll know where they go when they go away from the bait? They would go home. And in that way, and I'll tell you what the Buddha meant by this, explains it directly. The hunters were able to find, I think it's by noticing which loops got trampled down. That's the way that the deer are escaping. That's where they're getting away from us. And they went to the home of the deer and caught all of the herd and the tree. What Motam Buddha says he means by the hunters finding out where the herd goes home to, where they try to take refuge, yeah, where they have their walls, is, what do you think after the talk today? Ideas. They have this idea or that idea. So the ideas are, and they give examples, their views, then they have views that the world is eternal or the world is not eternal. Either of those views is good enough to be caught by the hunter. You have views that the world is finite or that the world is infinite. Any view of this kind is enough that the hunter will come and find you where you live. If you're taking refuge in a view, and what we mean is when we're being loyal to an idea instead of to something that first feels joyful, that's helpful, and then there's lightness, that's helpful, and then we don't know how we know, but we know. It's so light, we can't even put a finger, but we can still do it. The truthful guide that's worth following. You can believe that the soul and body are one, or that the soul and body are separate, or that the soul and body are both separate and not separate. That after death, Tathagata, an awakened one, exists, or that it doesn't exist, or that it both exists and doesn't exist, etc. Any of those is taking is having walls that you don't need through an idea. And what the hunters are is the forces of non-freedom in that are active in human being, in every human being. Say it. So luckily there's a fourth herd, and then it's the end of the talk, don't we? So the first herd, fourth herd, notices and learns from the other three herds, and also they are as sorcerers and witches. And they say, we will be not too close to the bait, not too far away. And when we go home, we will go where the hunters cannot find us. Where the hunters cannot find us, the way it's in the text, is meditation. But it's not meditation as my idea of meditation. It's meditation that keeps going naturally, unfolding deeper. And it starts with joy and rapture, even though there's thinking in the mind. So if you've heard of the jhanas and then the less material states that naturally can unfold, it gets more and more subtle by itself. And then it's so subtle that what they call the taint. So what's deep in our psyche and in our being, that taint means it's like as if could be tainted food, which would be bait, or it could be something that's tainted with a color, so it's not clear. The taints are destroyed. It happens by itself. And what this does is it blindfolds the hunters. It makes them unable, it makes us invisible to the hunter. It may, and I love that it's a really funky old-fashioned phrasing. It deprives Mara's eye of its opportunity. Mara literally means death, and it's here as an actual figure of negativity, of destructiveness that comes and finds us. We can either personify it or not. We can experience how strong the habit energies are, how strong the kind of collective biological energies are, and what they have made you do, and what they've made everyone do. And how simple. It's not about being stronger than the destructive forces. It's not about beating them back or ignoring them. It's by being ignorable that they are not interested in. So the end of the story is actually that the hunters say, oh, well, never mind. We can't catch them, so we'll pretend as if they don't exist. So not our own, but coming to where the negativity has no interest, no investment. Any question or comment? Yes, meditation. Okay. So, but meditation that is not, I'm meditating because I like the idea of being a meditator and improving myself. It's not a meditation because I hate myself and I hate life and I've got to get out of here. It's not meditation as walls where I'm safe. It's meditation that has its own way that it keeps on going. And sometimes it feels like at the top of the hill of the roller coaster, free fall. And sometimes it feels nothing's happening. Something should be happening. How do I know what to do? And then we are less and less interested in how. And we're more and more in the embodiment of it happening. And description also, less and less interesting. Description can come later, after it's happened. So it's a kind of allowing a refinement of our sensing of what meditation is and how it goes, how it can go naturally more and more subtle and less centered around me or the idea of me. Anything else? Okay, great. And I'm going to be here for maybe 20 more minutes, too, so feel free to give me a hug, even if you don't know me, or ask questions privately.